Mouthing Off is a theater, arts, and culture podcast from Bad Mouth Theater Company in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Amanda Forstrom.
I'm Kevin Couchman.
And I'm Mari Sittner. Mouthing Off features compelling interviews and discussions with artists and creators from around the Twin Cities and beyond.
Tune in for something different online where you get your podcasts at badmouthtc.com and on the air in St. Paul through Frogtown Radio 94.1 FM.
And if you've got something going on around the Twin Cities you'd like to talk about, we want to hear from you. Email us at badmouthtc@gmail.com.
Mouthing Off is sponsored by Minnesota Playlist, the digital destination for live performing arts. Producers can find talent to work with, directors can cast productions with audition ads, teachers can find students with a classified, and audiences can find the perfect show to attend on the state's largest calendar of theater and dance shows. Find out more at minnesotaplaylist.com.
We hope you enjoy the show.
We are back with another episode of Mouthing Off, the Theater Arts and Culture Podcast from Bad Mouth Theater Company, badmouthtc.com. I'm Kevin Couchman. It is the holidays. It is the winter solstice, the darkest day of the year. But we're gonna try to keep it light and fun. I have a guest here, a friend of the pod, probably our most frequent guest, which is like very exciting. Matthew Kelly from Dark Pony Radio. Matthew, how are you?
I'm doing good. Doing good.
Yeah.
Enjoying the okay. Winter.
It is. You have to. I mean, we're in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm in St. Paul. You're in Minneapolis. We can be friends. But you have to lean into it. You have to enjoy it or else you get destroyed.
Yeah. It's after not having a very snowy last year. I'm kind of excited to see how it goes this year.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of miss the snow. The cold, I can do without the negative 40 degree temperatures,
but that's what I'm talking about. And you know, and this year I've kind of tried to we had the cold snap. Okay, so this is very inside baseball for people in the Twin Cities, but you understand this. You have the cold snap and suddenly it's like, you know, negative 2 overnight and like 6 degrees, 8 degrees in the morning Fahrenheit, and you just, it's that cold is different from 30 degrees.
Yeah,
it is. And
When 30 degrees feels like spring or summer.
Balmy. Right. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So I'm trying to, when that, when that comes around, I'm trying to just like, I'm muscling this year. In any event, you know, we're going to, we'll make it. We're already, it's almost January already. So
We'll get through it.
So you were saying you have Drinking Game coming up. I mean, get your plugs out of the way right away.
Oh, sure.
That's one of the things we do on this show.
So we run the monthly Drinking Game Minnesota here in the Twin Cities, and this show will be at the Hive Collaborative.
Oh, we love the Hive. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great location, St. Paul. And I want to say it's at 7 p.m. I'll have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure it's at 7 p.m. If not, you can check on their website. The ticket link is up. We'll be doing How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the Jim Carrey version.
Oh, no.
Live, and it'll be shenanigans will be happening. So we're excited because it'll be the first time we've done something after the holiday. Usually we're doing something well before, but you know, theater and holiday usually is just crazy. Everyone's doing a holiday show, everyone's doing a version of Christmas Carol, everyone's doing something for it, so it'll be fun to do it afterwards. So yeah, if you have family in town and just want to do something on the weekend,
say a day? What was the day?
Saturday, December 27th.
Okay. All right. Yep. Okay. I'll see
Saturday
if I can. Yeah. I'll see if I can sneak away. It's funny that you mention the Grinch, because I just saw a tweet that was really, really funny. And it was something to the effect of like, what's the most ridiculous thing your father has ever done? And the reply was, my father wrote a screenplay, like a sequel to The Grinch with Jim Carrey. And every Christmas he gets hammered and he rants about how we didn't support him, we didn't believe in him, and that's why it was never me. Amazing. <You know>. Right. Yeah.
That's the only reason, right?
Right, because that's how Hollywood works, right?
Yeah. Jim wasn't attached to the film, to dad's. Yeah, that'll be great. So you have to assume somebody's hearing this for the first time. So what is Drinking Game? What is this?
We do a, the best way to say is what we do is it's a glorified stage reading of a cult classic movie. In this case, it would be How the Grinch Stole Christmas, where we have actors play out the parts as best they can to the original film. We have a narrator who kind of directs the action and has a bell. And every so often there are certain keywords for depending on the movie where the bell will ring and the audience can take a drink. And then there's an actor portion of that wherever, whenever an actor hears their character's name said by another actor, they drink. So we have actors drinking on stage. We have audience drinking on stage. And everyone's just kind of there to have fun and engage in the silliness of theater. It's definitely a show. We've had audience members. I should say it's been going on, I think, 13 years now. So we've been doing this for a while. And we've had audiences that don't see regular theatrical productions. They don't go to theater shows. We've had several audiences come in, members, and say this is the first time they've ever actually been to a theater production. And it kind of prompted them to start going to more theater, to follow some of our actors around town. And all of a sudden, the world just like opened up for them. Because it didn't feel like going to the Orpheum or the Guthrie where they feel
sure,
kind of out of
place sure.
at times.
Because the Guthrie is the least inviting theater venue in Christendom. It really is. I like IKEA, right? So yeah, but it's like if IKEA, and I understand that the Swedes, you know, in any case, theater in America does a really, really poor job of inviting people in. And so that's very cool that you make that, that's like part of your mission.
Yeah. We've always stemmed from the idea of making things accessible to people. You know, we're starting to get back to a spot again where theater's being priced out for anyone that's not in the community or can afford $400 tickets per person.
That's great. That's that's absurd. Why is it? I have some ideas about why the premium is put on the premium that is put on live performance is, it's a nod at like the worth of the thing. Mm-hmm. But it shouldn't be that way. There should be a way that we can make plays and make theater and make musicals where somebody who's a student can come out for $20, get a ticket, general seating, goods, you know, whatever. They get there early, they get a bite to eat, and it should be affordable for sure.
Or if the tours were more affordable compared to like the original run or the original cast running it, you know. Even the tours are now being almost as expensive as some of the, like if I was to go to Broadway and see it.
That's absurd. It shouldn't cost you $800 to go and see a musical. This is ridiculous. But this is for the podcast Down by the Docks. This is a different podcast, but we as creative people, as artists need to really think about what we're doing. I mean, do you think that the administrators who are putting those prices on those tickets feel good about it?
I think it's hard to say because I don't know what their costs are for some of these theaters. And it might be just so outrageous that in order for them to even function as a theater, on top of paying out a cast of like 60, 70 people, including understudies, maybe they, you know, and it's popular. So why not hit them up when you can?
But I mean,
It's hard, like it's a hard mixed bag because you want to pay the people that are doing the production what they're worth, but on the same end you want to make it accessible for everyone. I still feel the more seats that we have continuously going, the more money you're going to make in the long term. The higher turnover you have, the more money, no matter if it's like,
well, and this
if,
is
if
what
it was
the
$50 seats and you added more shows and had a longer run, you would be making the same amount of money, if not more.
Fair enough. Yeah. Right. I mean, but what you're dealing with is this. I mean, we're talking sort of above the level of this podcast, you know, but we're but you're talking, you know, not in a present company excluded. We can have this conversation, but you're talking about structural problems at the societal level. Like literally people can't pay their rent, people can't pay their bills. And so you have to charge this exorbitant rate, and then you have this big fat administrative layer, and they all have salaries. The artists don't. It's a mess. Like structurally, all the incentive has been
And it comes down to business model too, because a lot of those business models also are built on ticket sales only. And it's like you're only making your money off of ticket sales. Well, that's the problem. I mean, that was the problem for a lot of theaters that own spaces when what happened, like, was it the big housing boom that happened? Like, what was it, 10, 15 years ago or whatever? The bubble popped and everything kind of like,
The recession in 2007, 2008. Yeah.
And theaters
which
were struggling.
Which we never recovered from. Yeah.
Mostly because everything was based off of ticket sales. And if you're basing your entire theater off of ticket sales, you're never going to make money. I mean, that's been proven even in movie theaters. They can't make money off of ticket sales. That's why concessions are the prices they're at.
You're totally right. And I go to see the movies at, well, one, I got to shout out the Heights Theater in Columbia Heights. I love that place. I want to have those people on. Have you, you know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. I have not been there, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
You have to go. So you absolutely have to go. The night before last, I went to see Terry Gilliam, a great Minnesotan, the only American Monty Python. I went to see Terry Gilliam's Brazil with one of my oldest buddies. Yeah. And they have a guy, and it's one screen, and it's old-timey theater, and they have popcorn, you know, and it's $6 a, you know, it's real butter popcorn. And you can go up to the Mediterranean restaurant up the way. It's strip malls and like good food, and oh, it's a great night out. And tickets are like $12, and we saw Brazil, and they have a guy who plays the organ before the show. Amazing. I took my wife, we saw White Christmas earlier this year. That is a carnival to get parking, to get, anyway, you have to know that play. It's incredible. It's like the oldest continuously operating movie theater in Minnesota. How did we get to this point? I don't remember. But I want those people on. It's amazing. But there's a way to do these cultural institutions, and there's a way to like put butts in seats. I think like talking about theater, it's about habits. It's about building habits, creating a theater-going audience, and we're up against. Like, it's like war. Have you played video games recently? Like, what we're up against? It's brutal. How do you grab, and I'll tell you what the answer is. I'm setting myself up here. I'll tell you. The answer is Eros. The answer is humanity. Like, literally, just being among people. There's nothing better. You can play Red Dead Redemption 2, right? It's fun. It's great. But there's nothing like being among people. And that's what theater has to offer, that social scene. And if we were wise about it, we'd be inviting young people in. This is something they do very, very well in the UK. You know, it's always £10 tickets, student tickets, come on out. Because you're, and I'm going on a little bit, but you're teaching people how to be people in the theater.
That and giving them a slice of entertainment that you can't see anywhere else. Stories that can't be told necessarily the same way. You know, there's so much. There's so much that can come from that. Oh,
yeah.
I mean,
no, I mean, right. I mean, we're on the same team. So this is sort of like preaching toward the choir. Why don't you? So, OK, drinking game. Tell people where they can find it. And then we'll talk about Dark Pony Radio, which is for the digital people. Yeah.
Yeah. The Hive Collaborative is where we're at on December 27th of this month. I believe it's a 7 p.m. show. You can get tickets on their website. They're already available there. I do stress on purchasing early, as sometimes, you know, it's a good chance the show will sell out. So please do that. Purchase early. Just that's what I'm going to say. That's it. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, great. Yeah. So, okay. So you're doing the Grinch here. Yep. So how does this go? So have you done this? You've done this before. So your actors are kind of familiar. So now
the
you're
Grinch?
Getting in it. Yeah.
Or we've not done the Grinch before. So
you've not
done the Grinch show.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Are you acting in the Grinch? Or
I am not in this one. So I'll just be hanging out as a producer and enjoy.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So the way this works is they get the screenplay. They get, and then how many actors are we talking about? Like six, seven, eight?
Somewhere around there. I think it's like 8 for this one. It's kind of dependent. Usually it's dependent on how many various people we have, because we have actors who play multitude of characters. Because, you know, there's in movies, there's a lot of one line characters, or there's that one person that just yells, "Hey," sure. And we need someone to say that.
Huzzah.
Essentially. Yeah. So, and then we usually don't have our title characters. So like the person playing the Grinch or any of the other Whos that have like a bulk of the lines, we tend to not give them extra various just because there is a lot. And, but it depends on the movie. Every movie is different. I mean, we did When Harry Met Sally, and that was,
oh man,
6 of us, I think 4 of us. No.
So much fun. What did you do with the cafe scene?
Oh, we just do it.
You just did it.
On stage. Yep.
Amazing.
Just do it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the midpoint.
Yeah. It's just about having fun. And, sure. You know, we take it seriously. It's still a theatrical performance. We still take it as such, but we're there to have just as much fun as the audience and hang out and just kind of enjoy the atmosphere of it.
And the Hive is a great place for that too. It's very homey. Yeah. Very cool.
Very intense.
All right. So, tell people about Dark Pony. What's going on in the Dark Pony radio world?
We're back for season 4. And I know we've talked on on this podcast before multiple times about Dark Pony Radio. We've been hitting a lot of the festival circuits this past year, and we still have some more coming up. In fact, we just got, I think we just got notified of one springtime film festival. We just got best podcast, I believe. For us. So it's another little thing there. We were also at the Minnesota Web Fest, where we got best ensemble this past year as well. And we were up for some in Rio just recently too. Unfortunately, we did not win anything in that one, but we were still nominated and was still wonderful to be part of that world still.
So it's for people again who don't know, it's like a radio show. You're doing old timey radio.
Sort of, yeah. Like it's a hybrid of that old timey radio feel mixed with a cinematic kind of modern style to it. I've had people describe it as though it feels like they're watching the movie as they're listening to it, kind of with how our sound engineer Benjamin Conklin does with the surrounding sounds, just creating a whole atmosphere beyond the writing. And we just released our second episode earlier this month, or the end, like near Thanksgiving-ish time, beginning of December here. And that would have been our second episode for season 4 with Medea. And talk about atmosphere. That whole show is full of it. Everything from driving in a car to depth in space of living room to a kitchen, back and forth to upstairs to downstairs, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I have writer friends and I, because of course we did Basilisk last season. So I have writer friends and I sort of say, like, this is a company that you should go to. This is a production. Go do this. Like, this is it's very interesting, low production. Like, not that it's, how to say that, not that it's cheap, but like, you know, it's a way to actually realize something in the world. And I think that so many of us, well, I have a lot of thoughts about this. You know, we grew up in the 80s, the 90s, some of us the 70s, but, you know, before my time. But like, you know, you grew up in that period and your gold standard of media is television and Law and Order and whatever else and X-Files and Twin Peaks and blah, blah, blah. You have no idea what it takes to put something like that out. Millions of dollars to do properly. But they part of the charm of shows like this is that they make it look easy, because if it doesn't look easy, it doesn't work, right? Can you imagine the Sopranos in cinema verite and shaky cam? It wouldn't work, right? So it's like the formalism of these things and the great high art of cinema is part of the charm. But as a child, you have no idea. You know, so that you grow up and you sort of go, how do I make something radio drama? radio plays. There's a way you can control the environment, you can control the story, control the narrative, and make something spectacular. And I really think that, like, people who are working on low, whatever Wookiees out here in the Midwest who are just trying to, like, snipe at the culture, I think it's like a great project. I really do. And you guys, like, you put the effort in to make something that is self-sustaining and cool on its own.
Oh, we're always trying. We're always trying to find the next story, the next thing to put up, the next fun. Yeah. I mean, how was it for you? I mean, you wrote the last two episodes, or you helped write the last two episodes of it with that whole production. How was it for you going through that whole?
Well, it was fun. It was fun to write. It's fun to write a radio play. I wish that more people, and I'll nod to our little weird corner of the internet, I wish more people would consider it. It's a strange one because I've yet to see anybody achieve any kind of social status from a radio play in America. It does not happen. Not in our lifetimes. Everybody wants the novel because the novel... I have a lot of thoughts about this. Like, everybody there, who said this? Might have been Faulkner. Don't be a writer, be writing. Like, we have a lot of writers now who are, there's a lot of posing and a lot of posturing. And if you tell them, no, hey, wait, there's a way we can get your dramatic story over, but it's not going to be in front of a million screens. You know, 1,000 people might hear it. They're, you know, people want status. They want to feel invited to the party. But I can tell you, I've been to these parties. They're not that great. I've been close to these parties. Like, you know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, this party leads to another party. This thing opens up that door. We've been going to these festivals. We've been going to festivals, been trying to go and talk with a podcasting community, which is a whole separate, interesting, and wonderful world. And I highly encourage anybody that does podcasting to try to get out there more in the community and meet and greet. There's just this sense of we're all in the same boat, so why fight it? Like, why aren't we all helping each other get to that next spot? Hey, here's this contact who
you gotta
into a network. Reach out to them. Like, stuff
listen,
like that
I mean,
big there.
My philosophy, and I'm very happy with Basilisk. Like, we'll talk more, you know, there's more behind the scenes. But you have to make what you love for yourself first. And which is like sort of ironically, it's very narcissistic. But we're not all going to be Denis Villeneuve. We're not all going to be David Lynch. And we all wouldn't want that. Like, I don't want to run a film set. That's not what I'm cut out for. It would not be good, you know. So you have to, like, find ways to realize finished product for yourself. It's why, novelists, you say, sort of write short stories. Finish three short stories and sort of see how you feel and see if you can get them placed and people can go, wow, that was a really good short, you know. Same with plays. Finish a 10-minute play, sort of see where you are and then, yeah. But my point around all this is that for the radio drama, it's so great because a lot goes into it, but you can realize something. And I really, really love that. And I think there's more of an audience here than maybe we would think otherwise, right? Like Rogan, Joe Rogan had a deal with Spotify. And somebody's listening, you know, to these long things. And that's good. How long have you done? How many seasons are you in, Dark Pony?
It's our fourth.
Okay.
And I'm claiming it to be the darkest of our seasons so far. I think we've hit that. Hopefully in the first two episodes we've hit it. For the first time in a while, we felt the urge to put trigger warnings or content warnings rather for our first two episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Because of some of the content that's in it. For episode one, there is just, without giving too much away, I will just say there's a content warning for gun violence, which typically we don't normally put in there, but for this one we kind of make an exception, and once you hear it, you'll understand why. And then for our Medea one, we definitely have put in a content warning for domestic abuse and suicide, because we hit pretty hardcore in that one. I mean, it's Medea. If you know the classic story of Medea, you know what you're getting into. So, but we'll see where it goes. We're gonna be getting to darker and darker places to try to push that envelope with content and with sound and environment. You know, trying to make it more interesting that way and see what we can do and get through on the radio of just being an audio. You know, we tried that with a transformation horror and things like that, like timing and how long can we hold an audience to listen to just this sound before it either gets to a point where like, okay, I'm done. Now let's move on to the next thing. And how it just playing with all those elements where I could watch, you know, a movie and sit there and watch a 10-minute still shot and be intrigued by it based on the film or what's happening in that 10-minute still shot. It's harder to do when you're just listening. Very easy for your eyes to wander and find something else. So it's So season 4 will be an interesting thing. We're going to delve into our host characters a lot more too this season and kind of find out what they're all about. Yeah, we got stuff. It's going to be.
Yeah. No. So tell us about these host characters. Who are these characters and what's going on there?
So we've had 3 host characters since we started. It originally started with our original character called the Pale Lady. And she hosted for the first few episodes by herself. And then we brought in our second character, the Dark Gentleman. Both kind of unknown characters. No one really knew. They had their own cadence of talking, their own sound connected to each character. So like the Pale Lady has a very distinctive cackle. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful cackle. And then Dark Gentleman has a clicking sound that he does with his mouth. And then our third and most recent hosts now. So our 2 main hosts right now are the Dark Gentleman and our new one, the Scarlet Courtesan, who does a creak with their voice or vocal fry for those that might know that term as well. And it's just very uncomfortable. And the vibes between the 3 of them are all different. We have like the Pele is this fun, kind of sensual, intimate character. We have the Dark Gentleman, who's just very much about wordplay, wordsmithing, and just kind of follows with whatever the vibe is going at that moment. And we have the Scott Courtesan, who is just pure twisted, very dark, very hard, dark line compared to the other two. So it's kind of interesting to see where they're going and kind of delving into how dark and creepy are these characters, where they come from, or possibly where they come from, not necessarily the full truth, but just like the Joker, one of the multitude of those origin stories.
Sure. So yeah. What are the, give me some episodes that we can expect in the next, like the 3-4 months for this. Yeah.
We'll be
and
doing
where people can find it. Yeah.
Oh, sure. First off, you can find Dark Pony Radio on pretty much any podcast site. Because the Google podcast is no longer, so you definitely can't find it there, but you can find it on any major podcast site, Spotify, Apple, wherever you kind of find them currently. We do have it on YouTube as well. It's audio YouTube, so you won't be seeing a visual version of it yet, but you will be able to hear and do it audio through YouTube as well. You can always check it on right now, our website of shadowhorsetheater.com. And anywhere else, or you can just Google Dark Pony Radio and usually the first link will pop up with our host site, but you can also hear it from there. So it's
so what's next? There. Like what episode is next? Like what's happening?
Next episode. Sure. Let me go. I haven't actually posted anything about the next episode.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Okay.
I'm here to announce it. It's going to be called, let me pull up the title just to make sure I don't
get it.
The title.
Go and grab it.
Hold on 1 second here.
Yeah. Very exciting.
It's called I Will Not See, Punish Me. That's the next one coming up. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting kind of returning to my roots of found footage style. It's a different type of found footage. So we'll see how that goes. Kind of expands.
Who's working on that? Like who's behind that?
The cast for this one myself. Let's see. Self is it in this one? I have the cast list. 1 second.
You got it. No worries, man.
So many.
A lot of people.
Our featured person is her name is Kayla, and she's our featured performer for it. And then we have. I just know there was some mix up because of your show. We have Matt was stepped away for a while, so you could work on your stuff.
Oh yeah. To work on moderation, huh?
Yeah.
The great. Yeah. Yeah.
And I couldn't remember if he came back for this one. That's why I'm double checking.
That's all right.
But
dude.
Megan, normally then it would be Megan Noel Johnson and Nicole Lauren as well would also be helping out with that one.
All right. So how do you find the writers for this? What are your
right now? It's been mostly me, pretty much all me, except for you and Abby who did Basilisk. We have consistently been wanting to reach out to other people. People are interested. So if anyone is interested, please let me know. We're always up for finding writers and giving them a shot on here. So it's just a matter of what people have for time and how long, if they have something written already or if they want to write something up. I mean, how long did it take you to prep Basilisk?
Oh, probably 3 months to write Basilisk. I'm very proud of it. I'm very pleased.
Yeah, it's good.
It's a good one. We have some thoughts about it. There might be a publishing thing happening. I'll talk to you about it. But where would people, if they want to write a radio drama for you, for your production company, and you've got your gang of people together, how would they reach out to you? Because I know a lot of writers, I know a lot of weirdos and freaks on the internet. I consider them my friends. They might be trying to destroy my life, but that's okay. Like, when that's what the internet is, right? But where do they find you?
Well, right now, you can definitely find us on Instagram. That's a great way. We're consistently on there. Also, we just created a new email for stuff to take in resumes and any kind of questions they have. And that would be at darkponyproductions@gmail.com. You can connect it to us through that as well. Those are probably the best two ways to get a hold of us currently. We're going to be revamping our entire website, and that's coming up probably in the new year. We got a lot of projects coming up next year. So I'll probably be on again if you want to have me back in January or February to announce a big announcement later. But
okay. All right. Yeah. We have welcome.
Stuff in the fire.
Tell me. So I'm going to stand up. I'm going to use the little boys room here. But while I do, I'm going to ask you where did you as a child, as a person, how did the little Matthew Kelly end up doing Dark Pony Radio in the theater? Go on. I'm listening. I am listening.
That's a quite a question. Because I've been thinking about that a lot recently, actually. It's like, where did this all go from? I've been creative most of my life, running through stuff. I remember being very little, and one of my first actual theater experiences was this class I took at our community theater, and it had to do with, I don't remember all the specifics, but I do remember very, very vividly that we made and created little tinfoil cardboard swords and had a giant battle royale with all the other little kids performers and everything through the theater and did this big extravagant thing. And I kind of been creative since then. Writing, I didn't realize how much writing I've done until I sat down and really thought about it, but I've been writing pretty consistently since probably high school, as far as short story stuff, doing into college for bigger projects. My first version of Dante's Inferno was written in college, which now has been rewritten and redone for the podcast. And just kind of been writing here or there throughout it. My very first Fringe experience, I wrote a show. I wrote two shows, actually, for the very first time I did Fringe. Not the best shows, but great experience. Great to have to force myself to create something for the stage and just be happy with where it was in time for it to be rehearsed and put up. And, you know, it wasn't the best show. It wasn't the worst show, but it was definitely a good marker to see where I was at and see what I could do and see where it could go. And then horror started seeping in more and more as I got older, as I got more into the arts, more and more in theater, more and more in improv and everything. And I just discovered how much I loved horror specifically, and then, you know, got more in tune with my haunting experiences as well, eventually leading to more radio shows kind of started petering in around then. At that point, so I started diving deep into that and kind of all collided at once and has been kind of growing since, getting to a spot where it is now.
where did the horror vibe come from? Where did you, like, what are your influences in horror?
Oh, jeez. One of my major influences is actually Clive Barker. He's a huge influence on my horror. I fell in love with his writing, Hellraiser, the movies, all that. I just really enjoyed it. We got the opportunity to work on two of his plays, produce two of his plays, which also helped feed more into that realm of what can I do with horror. I mean, I've always been a fan of sci-fi horror to some extreme. You know, Predator, Alien, just throughout the big ones. You know, Event Horizon, for those that, I know that has a great fan base.
But, banger. Yeah, yeah. Classic. No, yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, I can even, very nice. What year was that made? 90s?
98?
Late 90s. Somewhere around there. Ooh. Yeah. It's like Alien, Exorcist, Jaws. It's all of it.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, so good.
And I've been a fan of Jaws since forever.
It's my favorite movie.
Cronenberg work. I didn't really think about it when I was a kid about who these people were, what type of films you did. You know, you saw them.
Like, I was afraid of the bathtub because of Jaws. Yeah.
Ooh. I mean, people were just afraid of water in general. It didn't matter where. Yeah.
Yeah. It was calling Dr. Freud.
Ooh, yeah, man.
It's amazing. Because it was, well, the whole, and the reason you are is because you are the shark.
Yeah.
It's like, and that's very, just, and you are, and in your life, I guarantee you are the shark.
Mm-hmm. So it's the horror inspiration has been growing more and more ever since. You know, it, like Wes Craven was a big one. Big influence, sure. I think, for film stuff. Nightmare on Elm Street was so definitely good. Up there. You know,
what a great, and also, like, I remember growing up in the 80s and the 90s, like, you put on the movies that really scared me in the 80s and the 90s, because I'm a hayseed, were Friday the 13th. Those scared the living hell out of me, because I grew up in a small town. We left our doors open. Like, it was, you know, so it's just this, like, real blunt terror. But yeah. Elm Street, for the real Tony suburbs, ooh, for the posh suburb kids, the idea that it could get into your dreams, you know. And what? Where are you watching those movies? You're watching them. You know, you throw one on at 11 o'clock at night. Mom and bed, mom and dad are asleep. Yeah, this guy, this creepy pedophile with claws, he's gonna come at you. Creepy.
Who then just becomes more goofy and goofy and goofy as it just keeps diving into this realm of just silliness the farther you get into that lore, which I always thought was interesting. But also, you know, it brings in that vibe of comedy horror that you didn't think was really a thing. But
sure. But I mean,
it started dipping into that well before it became bigger.
Do you think, like, even as they went along, they knew they were scaring 11-year-olds? Yeah.
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 They know exactly what they're doing. It's the same thing with, like, the Chucky, like, saga. You know, that started off as being just
the Chucky saga.
It really is, though, it's got its own TV series now.
Sure. I mean, that's a brand. I mean, that's a whole franchise. Yeah.
From my point of view, it got really dumb. I know a lot of people love the stupidity of it and how dumb it eventually it got, like, to just the point of, okay, we've gotten to a point now. And what I do love about those franchises is that they started leaning into it. I mean, like, this is where we're at. We're just going to lean into it and keep going.
Well, one of my favorite movies of all time is Jason X, Jason in Space. That is a banger. That's a banger. It is just a great movie. I feel really satisfied by that film.
Man, yeah. But people love those two still. I think there's still two. I mean, nothing will still beat the original for me, just because of some of it being such a cool twist, such a unique.
Yeah, right.
Story just goes.
Yeah, and super. And at the time,
it was like, what are we? This is unique.
It really was, and very. You're talking about Friday the 13th, and it's very lowbrow, very working class. It's like, it feels like that movie feels like ours. Feels like it shouldn't be as cool as it is. It's very cool. By the end, you just go, "How is this real?" And then, of course, like, two comes along, and. Now we're into, you know, the real monster can appear, you know. It's very cool.
Yeah, it's
it's subversive, like, genuinely. Yeah, you're never going to go to camp again. It's like, it's your...
It definitely kept that feel, the campfire story. And I think that's what also generally kept that, you know, it brought us that genre much more to life of a classic around campfire telling stories as kids. And, you know,
absolutely. I mean, that's, and that's the whole metaphor of the movie, is that it's like, you're, and now suddenly you're in it. And yeah, it's a work of art in on its own terms. Of course, it all goes back to Halloween. Nothing tops the, you know, the greatest, but you mentioned Hellraiser and Clive Barker. Hellraiser is so insane. That series is so nuts. I like to put it on, but it's crazy. It's like vampires and science fiction. What is it? Is it Hellraiser 2 or 3 where they're in the weird 80s? They're like in the Depeche Mode music video.
In the music video. Are you thinking about the Leviathan itself?
I think I am. Yeah,
that's two. So Clive did both 1 and 2. He directed the first two, and those are very slightly different in like they're gory, they're extremely gory. But number two, like top of the level gore compared to the first one. I was actually just talking about this with a couple friends of mine. Like, first one's gooey, is the best way to say it. The first one's just icky and gooey in the best sort of way. And then the second one's like, no, we're just going to go gore, and you're going to be here for it. You know, 80s gore, let's do it. But even the books hit that level. And what blows me away with Clive Barker stuff is how he can make something so horrific and so gruesome on a page come off so beautiful and so intense at the same time. You're kind of just like, it's such an interesting fine line. And I know, like, Hellbound Heart, which Hellraiser is based off of, you know, that it's all about like pain and pleasure and love and lust and all that. But be able to walk that fine line where I should be disgusted, but holy cow, this is just amazing.
It's genius in my head. Yeah, what's happening is that it's Edgar Allan Poe coming back through the French. And then the French existentialists coming back to America. And then the Americans going, how do I turn this into a carnival act? Because that's what we do. How do I pay the bills doing this? Right. Like, and you end up with these masterpieces of the macabre, and only the French and the Germans and then you have popular audiences who can kind of get behind it. Because it speaks to their multiple ways to appreciate these movies, I think is the point, right? You could watch Hellraiser as a sadomasochistic, like almost like a porn film, like a sadomasochistic porn film, but the normies want to watch the blood and the guts and the strange.
It's interesting. And I think like Hellraiser specifically too also changed the horror genre slightly even different by adding this whole element of, you know, it's no longer really a slash, like it could be a slasher, but it's really not.
No, it's
not. And
we're
dealing with interdimensional like beings, you know, and it's something a whole, it kind of felt like it was a whole new vibe for the horror world.
Yeah, I need to,
but at the
time. No, of course it was. I mean, I have to watch it again because it's super strange. It does not work the way it's like, there's like the monster in the attic and there's blood and you're trying to like regenerate your lost lover. It's very dark. It goes really hard into the sexual perversity that we've all sort of repressed. I mean, it all goes back to Rosemary's Baby, which is one of the greatest films of the century, and also about finding an apartment in Manhattan. You know, those anxieties that we have about the pill and about abortion and about women's whatever autonomy, those all come out. I mean, that's 100%, like by the 80s, that's, you get Hellraiser from those anxieties. And we just, everybody just, it shoves it down, but those are what we walk around with. So when somebody makes a movie that presents those anxieties in the most visceral way, the only way to do it is like to the nth in horror. Yeah.
And are the monsters, like, I really do loving and diving into the concept of monsters not being the villains. They're just
right
living in their point of the world, point of view of the world.
Yeah. Do you know what that's called? Like, do you know what that's called? Yeah. It's called democracy.
I see.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, really, it's, it's that GIF. I mean, you know, I'm not indicting you, but like the GIF, it's like, are we the baddies? The reason we resonate with these things is because they're pointing the finger right back at us. We relate right to that creature. Yeah.
Well, and I think it also comes down to the person watching or reading it and who they identify with. Like, I love monsters. I love villains. I love that side of things, because I always feel those creatures, when done, like, even you can say even to some degree, like the slasher films, you know, there's not much talked about like Jason. There's a lot of people talking about Jason, but not really about who that character is. You know, we kind of get glimpses of it.
Yeah, he's the little boy who was neglected by the camp. He was neglected.
Sure.
No, I mean, like, he's like, you're talking about all these incels and these anons who are online, who can't like be a part of society and who can't fit in and everything else. And here he is. Here's your monster that you've created because you've feminized society. You've made everything safe and nice and clean and cool. But then feminine sexuality comes up. They're all hopping on it. And he ends up drowning to death. It's not even that subtle. Yeah.
No. But I think it even goes back farther to Mary Shelley, you know, Frankenstein.
Yeah. Like, okay. Let's go
back there.
Yeah.
Let's go all the way back. Cause one of my favorite books, actually, it's one of my top 10 favorite books of all time.
It's a bang.
For those that have not read it, read it, go home and read it. You'll be, but the concept of the monster isn't really like, yes, the monster did some bad stuff in the book for sure. But did they? Like, that brings up the question. We paint that creature, the creature, as the monster, when in reality the whole book is Dr. Frankenstein being the vicious villain, the monster, the one that's brutal.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and some people identify with him being the scientist and kind of taking that avenue, but we still demonize the Frankenstein's creature as the monster, like a killing machine, something that's evil and twisted and demented. And it's like, No, it's really not. Take that look of a creature that's like half put to human.
Sure.
There's a visual.
Yeah. You know. No, I mean, it's, you know, it can be a yes and thing. Like, so, you know, it, like, the monster can be wicked because the doctor is wicked, which is would be talking about Europe, talking about America, which is reasonable because, like, I think behold the fruits. Things are not working out. but I'm with you. Like, it's, are you familiar with the paintings of Francis Bacon? Bacon?
I probably have seen them, but I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Oh, that thing.
No. Yeah. But it's very much, all of the stuff we're talking about is very much Francis Bacon. And I don't mean the old Francis Bacon. I mean the new Francis Bacon. And it's sort of like we're so good at hiding the horror from ourselves. Man, okay. Yeah. We're so good at hiding the murder and the death and the mob stuff and all of it, the terror. So I think there's room in our lives to like exhibit the horror. So I appreciate that you're doing that. Yeah.
Oh, thank
you. I want to go. Yeah.
It's so much fun. It really is the world of horror and writing is such a fun place to play. It's surprising to say that, but every time writing, it's a fun place to play. Doing it on stage, it's so much fun.
Yeah.
Doing film, doing the crazy grotesque things.
Well, because
people get grossed out about is so cool.
Right.
It's so much fun.
Totally, because what you're as soon as you say we're doing Hellraiser on stage, or we're doing even the Grinch is even kind of perverse and secular and not naughty, right? As soon as you say we're doing this naughty thing, then you have permission, and the audience, everybody in the audience wants the blood and the guts, man. They want permission to violate norms. Because also, like, and as we go along here, the norms are not working for anybody. Nobody's happy with the status quo. So we're going to spend the next 10 years like renegotiating the status quo, and freaks like us, weirdos like us, who try to figure out, why does Hellraiser work? Do you know what I mean?
Like, there's a lot of reasons.
yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. But we have a special place you got to feel it through. You got to feel it through. It's good. All right. Okay. So we've got to close down. Matthew Kelly, sure. give your pitch one more time. Where can people find you?
Dark Pony Radio. We're in the season 4. Episode 3 will be coming out probably, depending on the holiday, might shift things slightly, but towards the end of the month, if not the very beginning of January. But you can catch episodes 1 and 2. And of course, season 3, season 2, season 1 are also currently available, including Basilisk, which we talked in detail about. But check out the new one, which is Medea. It's a rewrite of Medea, a modern version. It's dark. Be prepared. It's dark. And you can find that on any podcast site. Also on our website, shadowhorsetheater.com. But any place you listen to your podcast, you get that. And then we also have the Drinking Game Minnesota this Saturday on the 27th. Or I'm sorry, this Saturday, on the December 27th. Next
December
Saturday.
27th, 2024, yep. Dark Pony Radio. Okay, 3 horror movies everybody should see.
3 horror movies everyone should see. Oh, boy. I definitely would say Hellraiser. I would even give the caveat of the new one as well. I would say The Thing.
Yeah.
And I would go back and say Haunting on Hill House, like the original, the old school, very original. Those would be my 3.
Okay. I'm going to say Jaws. I'm going to say Halloween 3.
Nice.
Yeah, banger. And then I'm going to say Funny Games, the original. Ooh. German.
Both are good. I saw the American one too. They're both good. They're both good.
It's worse in German.
I know. It's the most unfair movie I've ever seen. Unfair movie.